You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there, and thank you for downloading The Agenda's podcast from the 13th of June. That's today. And on the programme today, we actually put a bit of a focus on the impact of the floods nearly 2 months on. We talked about cars specifically because Dubai Police say they are introducing AI-enabled tech to help consumers detect whether a car was involved in the floods or some sort of other accident. We caught up with Naz Chowdhury, who's an automotive entrepreneur. He basically gave us his analysis on how it's likely to help. Meanwhile, increasing numbers of people are hearing that their insurance claims will not pay out for flood damage. Khaled Jishi, he's from Arab Loss Adjusters. He told us what percentage of people are currently out of pocket. And David Hasselhoff has a new job. He is head lifeguard at Aquaventure. Of course, that's up at Atlantis. Global branding expert Anthony Miles joined us to talk through the efficacy of hiring these sort of funny celebrities to endorse your products. And as Abu Dhabi's population rises to just under 3.8 million people, that's 83% more than 2011, we discussed the impact of these new inhabitants on property and also on schools. We had a couple of experts on the programme. It was really interesting to hear how things are changing there. And apparently, increasing numbers of robots are being bullied by people. The producer of the weekend tech programme, The Reboot, Zina Zalameya, explained what is causing the animosity. Welcome back to your Agenda programme. Right, it is one of those weeks where it kind of feels like every single news story features something about an AI upgrade. We've had, you know, the Apple intelligence announcement. We've had the AI retreat in Dubai's Museum of the Future. And there is a real sense, if you're sort of feeling optimistic, of every sector here in the UAE seizing the initiative and embracing a tech revolution. And in the latest announcement, Dubai Police say they are going to integrate AI systems into 29 of their administrative operations. I think many of them we probably won't notice. But usefully, one of the upgrades is apparently going to help prospective buyers of second-hand vehicles in Dubai. You're going to get access to accident history or, of course, pertinently, considering what's been happening over the last 2 months, flood damage. Now joining me to talk through the change is Naz Chowdhury. He is automotive entrepreneur. We know him well from Motormania, which is on, of course, pretty much every Saturday. Naz, lovely to have you join us on the line. What is your reaction to this announcement?
Yeah, it's really interesting how Dubai Police are at the forefront of this AI technology. You know, we saw it coming in the last year or two. And things are just improving. And as you said, it's one of 29 major AI powered administrative operations that Dubai Police are implementing.
I kind of thought you could already do this. I listened to Motormania and I've heard you guys talk about how you can find out a vehicle's accident history. Do you think this is just going to be an upgrade on what already exists?
I think it's going to be one of many significant upgrades as Dubai Police are overall improving their app. So yes, Georgia, you're right. Historically, you could go on, you know, EVG, which is Emirates Vehicle Gate, or the Ministry of Interior website, moi.gov.ae, punch in the chassis number and get any previous accident history. But to have it all AI-powered, amalgamated together under one database through the Dubai Police Smart App is a real improvement and makes it a lot more efficient for us as consumers.
Do you often see people sort of getting duped by... I call them picnic cars or jigsaw cars, you know, where things have been put onto other things?
Yeah, cut and shut, they're called in the industry.
Is that what the official industry...
Yeah.
You mean there's an official industry term and it's not picnic?
Yeah. look, I think Dubai and the UAE has gone a long way in terms of transparency in the past few years. Historically, in the past, it was very hard to obtain any information when you're buying a used car. And you're at the mercy of the seller. And, you know, there was a lot of people out there that didn't really disclose all the information about the car. But now, through the help of these websites and through the help of these apps, people can make a much better, more informative decision, as long as you use them, of course.
Yeah, I mean, that is the other thing. You really do have to plug and play with that. Now, Naz, my car drowned in the floods. I have talked about it.
I'm sorry to hear that. Yes, I think it was your Tesla, if I'm not mistaken.
It was a Tesla. They're not boats, despite what Elon Musk says. In fact, if you do end up being forced to drive them through a large amount of water, you start feeling very tense indeed. Thank goodness we had fully comp. I don't think you can get fully comp on a Tesla now, unless you're willing to pay about the cost of the car. And it was written off, I think aggressively written off, personally. But we did get most of our money back, bar 20%. And as a consequence, I am in the market for a second-hand vehicle. We're not going to buy it till September because I'm away for some of the summer. And we're trying to save a bit of money. But, you know, if you are going to go out into the second-hand market now, how cautious do you need to be?
Very cautious. And I think with the flooded cars, you know, there was reports of up to 100,000 that were officially written off.
Wow.
Now, if you imagine that, probably, you know, 4 out of 5 didn't get written off. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of cars that have potentially had some level of water damage. And that's like 10 times more than the amount of cars on Dubizzle today, right? So there's a lot of cars out there that would have had some kind of damage from the floods. Now, what I'd say is always get an independent inspection report, get the car checked out by the main dealer or a competent specialist. The only thing is there's really no guarantees, unfortunately, because with a flood-damaged car, even if it's been repaired quickly, it could work. But then weeks down the line with corrosion, electrical things, problems will just keep reappearing and reappearing. So it's very hard to put, you know, hit the nail on the head and say this car's okay or it's not. Unfortunately, I wish I had a magic wand to answer this, but I don't.
I mean, that is going to make it very, very difficult for people. And people like me, you know, my husband knows a bit more about cars than I do, but we're not exactly mechanics. And that's just going to make us super cautious of that market. Do you reckon we'll get more people buying potentially on finance rather than sort of buying new? You know, because buying new is so expensive. But I suppose one way of doing it is to break it down in finance.
I think the best way to break it down, if I was to give some honest advice, would be to buy from an independent dealership or a dealership rather than a private end user.
Okay.
The reason being is if you buy from a private end user, then there is no legal recourse. You know, generally there's a little piece of paper written on the back of the boot lid saying, you know, this car sold as seen between buyer and seller. However, if you buy from a reputable dealership, a showroom, somebody with a trade license, somebody with a registered VAT number, there is recourse. So again, through Dubai and Dubai apps, you've got, you know, consumer rights, you've got, you know, all these different places you can knock on if you find out something's happened to the car, you know, very shortly down after handing over the money. Whereas if you buy it from a private individual, your options are limited.
Really good advice there. Naz, always lovely to have you join us on the line. Thank you
Likewise.
Very much.
Thank you for having me.
And I will
mention one more thing if we have 30 seconds.
We do.
So, Dubai Police, if hopefully you won't need this, but it's always good for the motorists out there that do. If you ever have a car accident or a small car accident, you can very easily open the Dubai Police app, take picture of the crime scene, whatever the accident scene, and report, upload everything, and you get the police report online. Nobody knows this, so people hit cars and then they don't know what to do, and then it's too late. But Dubai Police have actually improved that app to 4 steps instead of 7. So this will really help users out there. So if you've got Dubai Police app and you are in a small car accident or something like that, make sure you go on the Dubai Police app and you can get the police report through AI immediately.
That is absolutely fascinating. I hadn't realized. So when they say 29 administrative tasks, there's another one
there.
This
is one of them. This is another one.
Oh, Naz, thank you.
Hopefully
we
won't need it. All right, no problem.
Well, fingers crossed. And are you on this week? Is Motormania this week or next week?
Yeah, so Motormania is on next week, not this week, but next week and pretty much every Saturday thereafter, 10 till 12, every Saturday, talking all things automotive, car reviews, shows, top tips and advice as usual.
Love it. Thank you very much indeed. That's automotive entrepreneur Naz Chowdhury, star of Motormania alongside Damien Reid. Can you believe it? nearly 2 months since those epic rainstorms and the floods. It's really hard to sort of imagine that it was only 2 months ago now because it's so hot out there. You know, can you imagine a rainstorm? It would be amazing. But yeah, it's 16th is the anniversary, the 2 month anniversary. And the reality is that even 2 months on, many drivers are still waiting for their insurance claims to come through. I mean, it was a pretty epic scenario. There are theories that about 50,000 vehicles were damaged as those water levels rose after the rains. We just heard from Nurse Chowdhury. He reckons it could have been as much as 100,000. And sadly, only vehicles that have got the comprehensive insurance policy tend to be covered against losses arising from natural disasters. And even then, insurance companies will often not pay out if the car was deliberately driven into floodwater. Now, we did hear from the UAE Central Bank in the days immediately after the floods, like I think it was day one or day two, where they said that they would expect insurance companies to pay out for people who had fully comp. And I think that's probably why we got our payout, because, you know, I did drive into floodwater. I had to. It was either that or sit and watch it rise around me and you know, therefore have, I mean, I don't want to be exaggerated too much, but I wasn't about to sit in a car and watch the water come up, you know, come up my window screen. Like, I'm sorry, but I'm not doing that in order to ostensibly save the engine. I drove myself to safety. And fortunately, the insurance company understood that and saw it through my eyes. But if they hadn't, we would have been down. Like, that's the type of money that hits a family for a good 5 years. You know, if we had been down that cash, it would have been a big deal for us. We're down 20% as it happens. But it makes me very sympathetic to people who aren't getting the money. And I'd like to know what percentage of people aren't getting those payouts. And I'm going to try and find out now. I'm joined in the studio by Khaled Jishi, who is the founder and managing director for Arab Loss Adjusters. So let's go back, first of all, to why some people, you know, haven't heard from their insurance companies yet. Why is it taking so long?
So, yeah, it's been a difficult situation since the floods 2 months on. But frankly, big credit and shout out to the authorities. I'd say the Dubai Police particularly, because what they did, and with their apps, their AI apps and their system-generated reports did, was effectively release 50,000 reports within 2 to 3 days tops. So that was fantastic.
I hadn't really processed that as a thought. Yes, that is incredibly impressive. Yes. I don't think they've had enough credit for that, oddly enough.
Yeah, absolutely. And then they basically managed to get that out of their, you know, out of their books, and then the responsibility is then with insurers, adjusters, surveyors, workshops, agencies. And that's where the trickle effect started to start, and the bottleneck started to arise. So effectively, of course, you know, we're in a country where everything's imported, a lot of cosmopolitan, a lot of foreigners, and we were not ready for this.
I mean, who could be? You know, I mean, I am a journalist. I'm a big fan of holding organizations to account. But the reality is that no one had ever seen anything like this before in this country. It was, you know, it was a proper natural disaster. Yeah. And as a consequence, an awful lot of cars were damaged. So unusually, I am sympathetic. Yeah. It doesn't happen very often.
It's true. We should be sympathetic. But I think that's where we all realized our gaps. All the industry realized their gaps, because effectively, that's why people are insuring. We should respond. The community and the society was hit and impacted, like you rightly said. Affects people's livelihoods for 4 or 5 years down the line if they don't get a payout. And the issue is that decision making was a little bit slow on that side, potentially with some firms and some companies. But I would say as well, that bottleneck with agencies not having parts, garages not being ready, And no one wanted to take the responsibility in the context of automobiles, vehicles. If they do decide that they're repairable, what would the repercussions be if effectively 2-3 months down the line there are some defects that arise? And electrical defects are quite dangerous. Fires could arise. There could be shutdown, especially in electric vehicles per se, because of the big batteries at the bottom, which cost a ton of money, about 30-35% of the vehicle cost. And they're not easily available to procure.
And they're not easy to put out if they go on fire. That's another major issue.
Absolutely.
Yes, I know that with Teslas, it's very difficult to get parts. Yeah. I think that's one of the problems that we're having facing, you know, getting it reinsured, oddly enough, you know, the car that we have got. Okay, so that is very interesting background there. Tell me about the people who aren't getting their claims paid? You know, what's the scenario there?
I'd say effectively there's so much accumulation going on because a lot of people as well in with comprehensive insurance as well as homeowner claims. So a lot of people as well didn't know that they have insurance through their mortgage schemes. So there's tons of claims, or if not equally as much claims through the banks. Through the banks who, you know, communicate with their clients, with their customers, saying, okay, if you've got a claim in your house due to water damage, please put it through. And the insurance companies then were flooded with, they had to double up on the intimations. And then putting that aside as well, then there's the property, the commercial spaces, pharmacies, hospitals, warehouse facilities. And
you get a sense there of just this extreme workload that the insurance companies are facing.
Absolutely.
How about though when the decisions are being made and you are getting that dreaded email or letter, it's mostly emails, isn't it, from your insurance company that says, look, even though you're fully comp, we've decided that ultimately you drove into the floodwater unnecessarily and therefore we're not going to pay out. Are you seeing that, or are for the most people getting their money back if they're fully comp?
Okay, so effectively, in our position as adjusters and surveyors, we were asked to create a scenario of loss, like you rightly mentioned. So if the driver had gone through the creeks that were, you know, the natural creeks that developed on the edges of all the communities, then the insurance company would effectively say that this was deliberate in nature, and you had an option whether you could avoid it or otherwise. So
I was on a main road. I was on Sakim Street, yeah, watching the floodwater rise around my eyeballs.
Yeah.
Might that be why I got paid out rather than in a residential area?
Potentially yes. And a lot of vehicles that were parked got the payout.
Okay.
Got the payout. But the cars that were, you know, moving around the streets, I was one of them moving around the street to see what kind of exposure we're going to have and what kind of readiness we had to prepare for in the office.
Must have been horrified.
For us, it's a nice challenge. And you know, we have to prepare as well. So we weren't prepared either. And I think the whole community insurance industry wasn't ready. But a month down the line, we started to recognize that you know, with personal line claims, they should be treated differently, domestic claims. I mean, motor vehicles and homes are different. You have to be sympathetic. You have to approach them with empathy. The decision-making should not be so rigid. And this is just my personal view, and maybe the insurers won't like that. But in principle, like in the Far East and in Europe and in the U.S., these get the priority. And then the commercial losses can, you know, come into play.
If you do get told by your insurance company that they're not going to pay out for some reason, can you argue back against them? Should you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's your right. It's your right, effectively. And now the central bank did initially send a mandate to all the insurers that you should approach them prudently and in good faith to all your customers. However, insurers as well, because they have a reinsurance treaty on the back end, globally, although there's a bit of retention locally, they have a reinsurance treaty. They have a lot of accountability to audit their files in a very clear and concise manner. And we as well started to notice that there were so many variables in the costs being presented, which is quite unfortunate, because if things were quite clear-cut, where everything is within a specific price range, because the cost of parts is a given. It's a known. The cost of labor is also a known in relation to that cost of repair. And if it's had the water level reached, let's say, the seat levels, the driver's seat level at a certain level, then they'd write it off automatically.
Yes, they do. I heard about that.
Yeah.
Okay, so as far as the amount of work that you have seen over the last couple of months, has it now slowed down? You know, you go out looking to go out investigating and ruling on losses. Mm-hmm. Are you still seeing new properties, new cars, or are you?
I think it's slowed down at the moment, but now we have full visibility on how we want to clear out the caseloads.
Yeah,
I would say, because we've done the investigations on the field, we've done all the field work once, twice, three times in commercial buildings and or residential spaces, and then we just have the tough job of advising now the policyholders that there are some things that are not covered by the under the policy, and some things that are related to gradual deterioration, such as waterproofing in their homes and whatnot. And then on the vehicle side, we're leaving that to insurers to direct to their customers.
Lessons learned, what would you say?
Lessons learned, I would say that we have to be a lot more ready administratively. There should be clear, some insurers decided quickly that for motor claims, we're going to decide to pay. Mm-hmm. So just assess, quantify, and just go ahead with it. But that was not the general consensus. It was, you know, depending on each company's policy. There should be a bit more, a bit more harmony in the way we approach things, especially when it comes to domestic claims.
You've seen, you've obviously been in this market for years, and like you said, your father was in the market first. Yeah. Have you ever seen this level of claims before?
In the UAE, well, surprisingly, when we first established in 81, we had, during a hailstorm, yes, there were around the same amount of claims, but now we're urbanized, so much more construction. So I would say the nature of claims and the magnitude of them has risen so much. And then we had the issue of February as well, by the way, the hailstorm. So this back-to-back, the back-to-back events basically made it a lot more difficult for underwriters or even the policyholders to repair in time. And then this came
Keep
on the
up.
Back of it, yeah.
Really interesting to speak to you. So thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Right. I've been looking forward to discussing this topic all morning. Have a listen to this. Tell you the memories that brings back. I think it's like 5:30 or maybe 6:30 on a Saturday, back when there were only four channels on the telly and I lived in Dorset, and believe me, my childhood was boring. So watching Baywatch was really quite a highlight. And as a consequence, I cannot tell you how excited I am personally that Aqua Adventure has decided to kick off its summer season with a brand new campaign starring none other than David Hasselhoff as head lifeguard.
Are you ready?
Yes! All
right! Now today, we're going to run in slow motion. Go! Slower! Chest out! Run to that hotel.
Hi, I'm David Hasselhoff, the new head lifeguard here at AquaVenture. Come on, you guys are invited. Stay tuned.
Okay, so for those of you who are too young to remember Baywatch, are you too young to remember Baywatch? Can anyone be too young to remember Baywatch? Didn't they bring it back? Anyway, for those of you who are too young, essentially, David Hasselhoff was an iconic lifeguard character in that program. He wore red shorts. He was accompanied by Pamela Anderson, who wore a very tight red swimming costume. And I think people were less excited about David Hasselhoff running down the beach than maybe Pamela Anderson. And they are bringing back his iconic lifeguard character in a campaign to encourage people to go to AquaVenture. They've even made a LinkedIn profile for him where he's described as head of aquatic safety at Adventure World. They've launched it all on social media. And of course, this does follow close in the footsteps of Ryan Reynolds, who stepped into the role of chief island officer on Yas Island about a month ago. So we're looking at sort of how effective these celebrity-focused campaigns can be. And joining me now to give us all the answers is Anthony Miles. He's the MD of Bond, a global branding agency. Morning, Anthony. Thank you so much for joining us. Quick question.
Morning.
Do they work, these ads?
I mean, some do. I guess that's one way of saying it, and some don't. I think it's kind of comes down to a few different things. I think you made a really interesting point right at the top there about like who, like the audience and who might remember David Hasselhoff. So I think a really interesting starting point to make sure when you're doing these things is to make sure there is an alignment between the people that you're trying to attract and talk to and the celebrity that you work with. So obviously David Hasselhoff works and is known by me, by you, people of a certain age and sort of, you know, but if you're trying to attract kids, maybe it's not going to land quite so well. So that's a really important factor at the beginning.
I have to say, he is looking very trim for a 71-year-old when you see him in the adverts.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, he's looking good for his age. I hope I look that good. I mean, what is the pull that these advertising guys are hoping for? Is it quite simply the fact that they've made me laugh, they've made me reminisce about my childhood, and therefore I'm more likely to go to their theme park?
Yeah, I think it's awareness. So obviously we're talking about it now. He's a celebrity. People know who he is. So you tap into that knowledge of who he is. So I think that's part of it. And then like you said, it's like tapping into the comedy of it in this instance. I think it is actually a good example because it is funny. It's, you know, it made me smile when I watched it yesterday. And so that's, in a way, that's good advertising. But again, I think it comes down to a few things. So obviously you need to align the values of your brand and your business with that celebrity. So I think AquaVenture and David Hasselhoff works really well. I think Ryan Reynolds and Yas Island also works really well. So yeah, I think it's tapping into their fame and connecting it to your brand.
Do you think it matters, and I'm sure AquaVenture would dispute this with me, but do you think it matters that they've kind of copied the idea of Yas Island? You know, Yas Island came up with this chief island officer a good few years ago now. Or am I being unkind?
I think you're being a bit unkind. I think, like I said, I think this is a nice connection. It worked really nicely. I think they've been quite smart in who they've used. So, yeah, there's nothing wrong with copying if you do it well. So, and if it works, and I guess that's going to take time to find out. But, yeah, I don't think it's that bad at all.
Do you think if you pick the wrong celebrity, it can just, I mean, they must be so expensive. It's quite, you know, you're putting your money where your mouth is on this one, aren't you?
Yeah, I think that's a big question mark. So I think there's, on the flip side of the good side, there's obviously a lot of risk involved in these things. There's obviously risk, big risk, if something happens with that celebrity. I think, you know, think of people like Tiger Woods and Lance Armstrong, who were big sports stars and went through big scandals. And obviously the brands that were connected with them had to kind of distance themselves quite quickly. But then there's smaller risk. Like you said, it's like can quite easily be a huge waste of money if you pay a celebrity a lot of money and it doesn't have a commercial impact. I think that's obviously a smaller but still a risk.
What's so interesting about David Hasselhoff is he's clearly, I mean, I think he's more of a European star rather than a global star. I might be getting that wrong, but I wonder whether we presume that this advert is aimed at us here in the UAE when actually it isn't at all. It's for the external market trying to encourage them to come to Dubai.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair point. Again, back to that idea of the starting point is always thinking about your customer and your audience and then trying to find people who will match with that. So again, you know, a famous example is, I guess, George Clooney and Nespresso. You know, they very clearly wanted to launch a new product. They wanted to give a certain sort of opinion. They wanted to make people feel a certain way about their product. And George Clooney fitted nicely with that. So it worked really well. I think that's been going on for nearly 20 years and been hugely successful.
Successful for both parties. Yeah, I can imagine. I think probably George Clooney's rather nice house in Italy on Lake Como is probably bought thanks to those espresso tabs. Well, the Italians would be furious. Anthony Miles, Managing Director of Bond, the global branding agency. Thank you very much indeed for giving us your analysis on that decision by AquaVenture World to employ the Hoff as their head of aquatic safety. And turning to a really interesting story now. And you'll have heard it in the news. Basically, Abu Dhabi's population rose to just under 3.8 million people last year. That's a striking increase of 83% since back in 2011. And I've sort of been doing the maths. I'm really bad at maths, but that's basically 14 years, 13 years. It's quite impressive. 12 years, probably, because they finished counting last year. Anyway, it's official figures from the census that was done last year. And it shows that the Emirates workforce almost doubled in the same period. And if you get into the numbers, you can see that Abu Dhabi's home to twice as many males as females. So that means you've got two thirds men, which sort of makes sense because, of course, we've got a really sort of large blue collar, mostly male workforce. The average age is 33. Now, these are the figures for the whole emirate. So if you break it down into areas, Abu Dhabi specifically is 2.5 million. That's two thirds of the population of the emirate. Then in Al Ain, you've got about a million. And in Al Dhafra, you've got about 280,000 inhabitants. So that's clearly a big uplift for the capital city specifically. And we wanted to find out a bit more about how it's impacted on the real estate market there. Because this is, I mean, we talk all the time about the number of people moving into Dubai. But the fact that Abu Dhabi's growing at this rate as well must have really changed the housing market. So a little earlier, I caught up with Andrew Koval. He's director of Henry Wiltshire International in Abu Dhabi. They are real estate agents. And he says they have definitely seen a change.
Absolutely. Particularly over the last year or so. To be honest, the numbers really did surprise me. I wasn't sure it was quite that big. When I last looked some time ago, Dubai was 4 point something. But to see Abu Dhabi, I think it's 3.8 now from those figures and 2.5 for the city. You know, it's high, but we are seeing a lot of new people coming in, seeing a real squeeze on properties. It actually really reminds me of when I arrived in 2008. There was nothing available. It was a nightmare to find anything. The quality then was really bad and the prices were sky high. And so we seem to be going through a similar pattern now, but at least there's stock coming on. But we're at another pinch point at the moment.
Obviously, we don't really get these figures broken down for us into nationalities. So we sort of seeking anecdotal evidence from you, anecdotal data. Where are people coming from? You know, these families who are looking for villas or apartments.
It's a tricky one, really. I just try and think of all our recent tenants and buyers, and I'm not sitting on the fence, but it's quite a wide range. I mean, there's a lot from East Asia, all professions, Europeans, a lot of Europeans moving in, mainland Europe, UK, but also from Asia, Hong Kong, Singapore, which is very interesting. I think a big win for Abu Dhabi. Moving into these ADGMs and those setups, people are actually looking now to Abu Dhabi as a new frontier, but certainly from Hong Kong, Singapore. We've got, you know, teachers, airline pilots, people working in finance. But then at the high end, ADGMs attracting a lot of talent. There's a lot of hedge funds moving in, bringing in some serious heavy hitters with them. And they're looking for very expensive properties, which we're helping them with. Investment banks, a lot of technology and AI. Abu Dhabi's really pushing that and investing in it and bringing in some very good people. But yes, it is a challenge in terms of availability, both for rent and sale. It started really in the villa market, and we saw quite a squeeze there over the last couple of years. And that's got tighter and tighter. That's obviously had an effect on prices as well. For example, a four-bedroom villa in Sadia Beach Villas, probably a year ago was around 400,000. We're saying 600 now, if you can find one. Five bedrooms, probably 550 up to 700. And then that's sort of filtering across. But what we're seeing is not just the premium end now, it's also the Raha Beaches and even Ream Island, which had a huge supply, and prices are actually moving up a little bit there, and rents are very, very tight, especially the buildings that are close to offices and facilities. These people obviously want that on their doorstep.
What are people looking for? Obviously, here in Dubai, there's been a real squeeze on villas, partly because of COVID, but also because people are staying longer. So they're having children. So they want a house with a garden. Are you guys getting young professionals who are happy with apartments, or are you getting the families who are likely to stay a bit longer?
It's kind of across the board. As I say, we've got teams in each area, so we cover everything. I mean, from Al Reef, where people are renting from 50 or 60,000, buying for 500, up to, you know, the big, we're selling Sadiat villas for 20 up to 80 million, which wasn't seen before in in Abu Dhabi. They were only Dubai prices, but and the aforementioned people, they're coming in and they want this kind of property, something of real quality that's been really difficult to find before in Abu Dhabi. But people have built their own, they've refurbished, remodeled, and there's demand across the board, I have to say.
I've heard a lot of announcements of big, big development in Abu Dhabi. And actually, if you drive out to Yas Island and Saadiyat Island, you can see there's big developments going on along that causeway, effectively.
That's
How
right.
soon yeah. are those properties likely to come on the market? Because you get a sense that there could be quite a glut then.
Well, no, I think there's sufficient demand. There's phases to all of them. You mentioned coming into Yas Island, there were a few apartment developments. There's a villa development with a golf course called Yas Acres. And the first three phases of that, you cannot get anything to rent or buy very easily now at a reasonable price. But there's two new phases coming at the end of this year. So that will mop up a certain amount of demand. Close to there, there's slightly lower priced villa developments, which there's certainly a lot of demand for. And there's probably a couple of thousand units coming there. But that's a drop in the ocean, I think. I think they'll get mopped up. There's Jubail Island on the way to Saadiyat, which is one of the ones you see. They're completing within the next year, 18 months. People are moving in, some are reselling, but again, they're being taken up pretty quickly. So yes, there is demand. And interestingly now, I mean, all these existing areas that we've seen for the last number of years, Reem, Yas, Saadiyat, Raha Beach, they have got future phases, but they're sort of expanding and coming to completion. There's a whole new area now, Hudayriyyat Island, which is on the west side of the island. It's a massive master plan, super high quality, world-class master plan. At the moment, half the island's dedicated to leisure. There's hospitality there. There's a massive new residential or mixed-use component. It was launched a couple of months ago. Very, very impressive. But it's a whole new area that'll open up because, as you say, historically, you've got that wave over to the east side of the island. But there's a lot of attention now, and that's selling very well, and something to watch with interest, I think.
Is there a sense that, like here in Dubai, we are all super conscious of this Dubai 2040 master plan? Is there a similar master plan in Abu Dhabi? Because, of course, the focus here in Dubai has been very much on, you know, more beaches, more recreational activities, things like cycle paths, and lots of green spaces. You know, that those are sort of three key components. And the idea of a 20-minute city, that's the other big element. Mm-hmm. Is there talk of that type of thing in the capital as well?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, as I say, when I first came, it was the 2030 plan, but obviously the world changed after 2008, so things took longer to transpire. But there's these individual master plans. So Raha Beach always had their plan, and that's developing well. Yes, Saadiyat, as I mentioned, but Hudayriyyat, as I say, is a whole new one. And it's exceptionally well planned. There's a lot of green space, there's beaches, there's the leisure. So it's not just about plonking in some apartments and villas, which is great to see, especially if you're coming from world-class cities elsewhere and people's expectations are very high now.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
And we're talking about that massive population explosion that has taken place in Abu Dhabi. I think it's fair to say massive, rising to over just under 3.8 million last year, up by 83% since 2011. We talk about Dubai all the time, but you know those official figures sound pretty impressive. If you weren't listening in the last 15 minutes, I'm just going to give you a quick update. Apparently, Abu Dhabi home to twice as many males as females. So you've got two-thirds of the male population there. Average age, 33. 33 is like a marriageable age. You could have kids at 33. Can you have school age kids? I think quite a lot of people do. I didn't, but I think quite a lot of people probably do. And so what does this big population increase mean for schools in the area? I'm joined now by an expert in the field, Kelvin Hornsby, who is Principal and CEO of GEMS World Academy in Abu Dhabi, also overall Senior VP of Education for GEMS Education. Lovely to have you join us on the line. Hello, good morning. What impact has this population increase had on Abu Dhabi's educational landscape? It's a posh way of saying, are the schools full?
Hi there, George. It's great to be with you. Our schools are, quite simply, our schools are full. I mean, we opened our first school back in 1988, 35 years ago, and that was the Cambridge High School. And we've steadily grown our presence within Abu Dhabi over this 35 years. But certainly with the seven schools we have now, catering with provision for almost 15,000 learners, we will have sold virtually every seat that we have when we open up for the new academic year.
Goodness me, that is quite interesting, because I remember there was a big influx from Hong Kong to Singapore during COVID or just after COVID. And as a consequence, the schools in Singapore were completely full and people were facing a choice of if they wanted to move, they were going to have to homeschool. Are we in that situation with Abu Dhabi now, or are you guys and other companies building more schools to catch up?
No, we certainly we're ahead of the game. Okay. In terms of the population explosion, as you described it. Here at GEMS World Academy Abu Dhabi, we've had a wonderful relocation into a fantastic new campus on Al Reem Island. When we closed what was the original PYP elementary provision in the city, we had 404 learners. Within 2 years, we will open up in August with 1,100 learners and the campus being up to capacity. So we've been watching this strategically. The GEMS Education, as always, has planned for it, and the quality of the education that we offer across all the curricula, whether that be American, British, CBSE, or Indian or IB, as I've already mentioned, all of our schools are full. We do have a second expansion block here at GEMS World Academy Abu Dhabi that will have absolutely brilliant state-of-the-art facilities for our older learners. And in addition, we have the third of the Founders brand of schools, GEMS Founders Masdar City, that will open up in September as well, which will be a school with a zero carbon footprint in terms of the cutting-edge technology and materials that are used. So that will hold, again, cater for 4,200 learners. So we're certainly in line with the growth. We will have future seats. As I mentioned, all current seats will be sold, but we are planning for the growth and the development of particularly those two schools.
So one of the ways in which we get anecdotal data is by speaking to schools, and also, you know, we talk to property people as well, like we just did with Henry, and actually Andrew rather. And one of the things, because you can tell I was up late last night, honestly, I'm falling over my words as well. But we don't get the breakdown of nationalities from the government, from the census. They haven't released that information. I'm sure they know it, but they haven't released it. But you guys can tell us, because obviously you see the different nationalities coming through your doors, and obviously they have preferences according to which curricula they want, you know, because, and that's why you have schools with different curricula. So can you give us a sense of where people are coming from, these newbies?
Yeah, absolutely. But what I would say is that we cater for tens of thousands of local and expat families. Mm-hmm. Our schools are really internationally diverse. Naturally, our CBSE school, United Indian School, tends to be the school of choice for the Indian population and nationality. However, our international schools here at GEMS World Academy Abu Dhabi, with the 873 learners that we currently have, there are 76 different nationalities, and not one nationality tends to dominate. And we see with our larger, more mature schools, if I took Cambridge International, for example, there are almost 100 different nationalities of children there. So you can see we're really internationally diverse and really catering the different choices that we have at the different fee points really do give a quality education across all of the curricula and across all of the fee points.
You guys must be getting quite excited about the coming museums that are due to be opened on Saadiyat Island over the next few years. We've got a natural history museum coming. Obviously, you've got all the attractions as well. You've got SeaWorld there. And we've got the Louvre, but then we've got, the Guggenheim coming as well. Do you think that is going to bring in more people? Do you think more people will be enthusiastic about living in Abu Dhabi once it has this real cultural backbone?
It is an amazing place to live, and the cultural experience that is being provided here in the Emirates is second to none. You've only got to look at the developments here on Reem Island, for example, with Reem Hills, between ourselves and Paris Sorbonne University. You look at the developments on Saadiyat Island, Jebail, as well, all the way through down to Yazoo's. That's extending towards us. Ramen Islands, in addition, real high quality and affordable housing at every single price point as well. So the Emirate is proving to be exceptionally popular with expats.
That is very interesting to hear indeed. And yes, of course, I forgot about the universities as well. We probably ought to get someone on from New York University, Abu Dhabi, which of course is very well established there. And of course, you get that sense there of you could continue on to tertiary education while still living at home.
This is The Agenda.
On Dubai Eye 103.8, the UAE's number one talk radio station.
Yes, you're listening to The Agenda. Georgia Tolley here. It's a really interesting topic we're going to look at next. I'm joined in the studio by Zina Zalamaya, who, as you know, is a producer of a programme that goes out at the weekend. It's called The Reboot, presented by Sonal Rapani. It's the tech show, isn't it, Z?
Yes, it's the tech show. So we talk about consumer tech like gadgets, apps that are made here. But the second part is really when we visit places here that are interesting, that do really good tech.
So you go out in the field?
In the field. Have you seen the our social media post about the Emirates Group Innovation Hub?
I actually have, yes. I spent an awful lot of time on Instagram. So yes, I have seen it. You basically go on science trips, don't you?
Yes, it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. It's good for social media, but it's also good to see what's out there. Because before, we would go out and see, you know, when we would brainstorm, we would talk about things that were happening outside the UAE. And we realized there were so many things happening behind the scenes in the world of tech here in the Emirates, and we just need to go and see them.
And they basically let you in. They let you in their secret labs.
They let us in.
With cameras.
With cameras, with the vest, the protective vests and everything. And the latest science field trip we went on, we visited the Dubai Future Labs. So this is a small, nondescript place in Emirates Towers. It used to be a restaurant.
What floor is it on? Is it now not, is it on the second
on the
floor?
Ground floor.
Ground floor. Oh, ground floor. Okay.
Yeah. So they kind of playfully call it the robotics kitchen. Basically, they create robots from scratch.
Cool.
Yeah. So they're given a directive from a company, from a government department, and then they get to work. They design it. They create a prototype, and then they test it.
Okay, that sounds very cool. What kind of robot?
All sorts of robots. The delivery robot is the one that we saw and tested on site. But first, we've been speaking to Khalifa Al-Kama, who is the director of the Dubai Future Labs. He runs the place. And we ask him, how is a robot made and what kind of experts do you need? What team do you have to put together to create a robot?
To really make a robot, you actually need doctors, people who understand the autonomy of physical structures, to get inspired on how the robot should look like. You need the mechanics, you need the electronics, you need software engineers. So number one, I can tell you, to do robotics and do it well, you need a very wide range of skill sets and a very good work ethic and collaboration to get the prototypes up and running.
Okay, tell me a little bit more about that delivery robot you were mentioning.
It is very exciting. It's one of the most visible projects. And this robot is being rolled out in phases. So earlier, they trialed it in the Meadows in Emirates Hill. So a really nice, quiet neighborhood. And it was quite a small trial. One robot, one product in it. They delivered pizza, basically. So the pizza had to be a certain temperature when it arrived at someone's house. So they got some feedback, made some adjustments in terms of the size of the robot, the height, the features. And this time they're rolling it out in Sustainable City. Now, we've been speaking to roboticist Laith Mahdi, the first ever roboticist I've met in my life. He told us all about this rollout in Sustainable City.
It's a much larger deployment this time. We have around 4 robots, 10 restaurants, with a supermarket and a pharmacy. It's very, very diverse. The community is much larger. The nice thing about the Dubai Sustainable City is a purely pedestrian, nice neighborhood. So they have golf carts, they don't have cars, which makes our life a bit easier. But you have far more people walking around. So we have to navigate between slow walking people, basically. And what we want to test this time is, how can we handle large order? How can we handle long distances? How can we handle different kinds of food, especially liquids and medications?
Okay, I've got so many questions. First of all, what does it look like? How big is it?
It's like a box, really. Like, but it's silver. It's a box on wheels.
Does it come up to your knee or your thigh? Or your
waist? Probably mid-thigh.
Oh, it's quite chunky.
Yeah, it's a little chunky. It's got four wheels, and it preserves the temperature of the food. It's got a little antenna. I think they adjusted it because most of the time, it's the kids that receive the orders from the robots.
Does it have a face?
It doesn't have a face, actually.
It doesn't have a face. Silver box. And I mean, this could only work in this country. Because if you try that in a city in the UK, someone would nick it straight away. They'd be like, oh, that looks good. And they'd trundle it into their car or van. And they disappear with it. I mean, I suppose it has a GPS, but you just have to disable that GPS. Or some kids behaving badly would kick it into a lake or a lock, a canal, river.
Funny enough, that is actually a thing. So when people see robots, there are some instances where, the robot, especially the humanoid ones that have arms, legs, heads, they tend to be threatened by these robots and they tend to hurt them. So that is a weird trend, robot bullying, that's been observed with a number of really notable instances of people harming these robots, just destroying them or wanting to take them down. And Sonal mentioned earlier on the show, there was a story in California about a year ago where a bunch of people attacked an autonomous car. So an autonomous car is essentially a robot. And so we wanted to ask Laith, the roboticist. Laith, is this a thing?
It is a problem. There is a field in the robotics world that's called the human-machine interaction. It's how you portray this machine. And if you think about it, there are a lot of robots that we use in our daily life, but they just don't look like robots, and that makes them very humane for us, like our washing machine. Robot doesn't have to move. Yeah, it doesn't have to literally have legs and eyes. Design is extremely important, the aesthetics of it. How you deliver this technology to normal people. If you design a machine in a way that people will reject it just because of the way it would look, then you failed, no matter how good the technology is.
So thankfully, during the trial run, the people were very pleasant around the robot. So that's a good sign.
Hasn't met my sons yet.
Oh, gosh, they should do a trial run in your compound.
Well, they
compound.
Love Opti. They like to suck, the Opti, the yellow one that they had at
poor
Expo 2020. They like to, no, they liked him. They were friendly towards him, but they wouldn't let him go anywhere. they wanted to have long, in-depth conversations with him.
Yeah, I mean, what if Opti was an introvert? And
I think he was, to be honest. He's just a dancing introvert. He didn't want to chat to anyone. He just wanted to dance to Thriller.
It's turning away from the kids. But one thing to note was, thank you to the Dubai Future Labs team for letting us in.
Yes.
Because, it's full of experts. And to finish a code, they need an entire afternoon. And they need their peace and quiet. So thank you for giving us that time.
The Agenda is live Monday to Friday from 10 a.m. till 1 p.m.